I'm fantasy author J.H. Fleming.
And I'm science fiction and fantasy author Philip Dreyer Duncan. And before I introduce our guest, I have a confession. I had the biggest face typo earlier when Jessica asked me, she was like, who's our guest this week? And I said his name and I absolutely butchered it in the worst way possible. And I'm terrified I'm going to do that on this recording. So I'm just going to own it right out the gate. Okay. So our guest tonight is a Nebula Award-winning author who's so famous he has his own Wikipedia page, which I have now realized is my new measuring stick for how famous someone is. Like, his is really nice. It's even got a picture and stuff. All this time, I didn't realize that he was too cool to be hanging out with us, which only makes me like him that much more since I've known him for years. He runs the Jim Bain Memorial Award for Bain Books and the National Space Society, which sort of makes sense based on the really cool day jobs he's had. And I'm going to say his name very slowly. Our guest tonight is William Ledbetter, otherwise known as Bill. Hey, Bill.
Hey, great job.
You're welcome.
Do you want to know what I said when she asked me earlier?
Well, I hope it wasn't bedwetter, because I heard that one a lot when I was in elementary school.
I said, she goes, who's our guest tonight? And I go, oh, only Billiam Bedwetter.
Yeah, that's not very original, Phil. I heard that a lot when I was a kid.
No. The bad part is I wasn't trying to do that. I wasn't trying,
Bill. No, I was going to say, I think he got tripped up when he said Billiam, because then his you know, mouth wanted to keep doing the B's, and yeah.
I carried the B. So this is a big week for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a new book coming out tomorrow on December 7th. We're recording
the
6th, right?
We don't hide. We don't hide any of that. It's fine.
Okay. And then my last day at my day job is on Friday, the 8th. So it's like I'll be retiring a few years early to be a full-time writer. So now I'll only have one job.
That is awesome. Super exciting. We are so stoked for you. That's basically the dream, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing. So we'll talk about that some more. First, like, tell us all about your new book that's coming out.
Yeah, I have a series, and it started out being published first by Audible Originals. So the audio version of each of these books comes out first, and then 6 months or more later, the print versions come out. But the name of this series is the Kill Day series. Which refers to an event that happens in the first book. The first book is called Level 5 and then Level 6. And now Level 7 is the book that's coming out on tomorrow. So, they're real a real wide spread of names there. But it works. It works in context of the books. Primarily, they're about AIs and how AIs became free and their interactions with humans. And there's a lot of cool stuff like nanotechnology and anti-gravity. In the second book, there's a lot of stuff starts taking place in space. The first book is mostly on Earth. The second book is about half and half, and then the third book is Level 7. A vast majority of it takes place in space as well. So, one of my point of view characters is named Mortimer, who is one of the AIs. And I've had people tell me, it's like, man, you do AIs better than people. And it's like, well, I don't know that that's. You know, a real compliment, but I'm glad you like Mortimer. You
know? It'll work out really well for you when the robot overlords take over the world. They'll be like, I know, we like this human. That's a good right. meat sack. Yeah. That's a good meat sack over there. um, So you said that was an Audible original to start with. So they went to, so the publisher went to audiobook first rather than paper or hardcover or ebook.
Well, it was actually a weird setup because my agent got the deal set up with Audible. But the thing is, Audible Originals, they work like a regular publishing house. So, you know, they paid me in advance and they pay me royalties and have, you know, they lined up the voice actor for the narration, mm-hmm. and they lined up the artist for the cover art. And so it works just like a regular publishing house, except they only take the audio rights. So 6 months later, I'm free to have it, you know, published in print and ebook. So I have another publisher, Interstellar Flight Press, who's publishing the print and ebook versions. So Level 5 and Level 6 are both already out in print. Mm-hmm. So Level 7 will be out sometime early next year, early to mid next year. So
it's going to follow that same. So it'll be audiobook first and then.
Yeah.
Wow, that's right. Neat.
Yeah.
Do you think, is that becoming more common?
I don't think so. And to be honest, I'm not sure that Audible is going to continue down that road. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard stuff in both directions on that. So, but I think Audible's really about the only one who do that. And, but they were kind of wanting, you know, books that, you know, that they got the first shot at, you know, so, mm-hmm. Like more people would buy the audio version and then would, you know, maybe buy the print versions or whatever. So they'd get a bigger piece of the pie, but it worked out. So
yeah.
I was a bit, you know, I was a bit skeptical at first, but it worked out really well because, you know, Audible is owned by Amazon. So they've got a really good marketing department. So yeah, worked out really well.
Yeah. I think it's neat the way they're kind of quiet about it too, right? The way they kind of run their own imprints. Because you would sort of think like, okay, if we're going to pick this up for Audible Originals, then we might want to try to get the paper and hardcover rights through like 47 North or something, right?
Right, yeah. And sometimes they do, but I had actually talked to one of the editors through my agent at 47 North, and evidently they publish a lot fewer titles every year than Audible Originals do. So
that makes sense.
You know, you have like, I don't know, 50 Audible Originals come out, but only 20 of them can be published by 47 North if, you know, they decide.
They probably start pitching them over. They're like, we're doing this one. We're doing this one. And 47 yeah. North is probably like, we have our own pile we're working on, guys.
Right.
We'll take
turn
two.
Off the fire hose, would you?
Yeah, right. Well, you also just had a short story collection come out a few weeks ago, too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, for most of my career as a writer, I've been a short fiction writer. And so, you know, I have a lot of stories published in magazines and anthologies. You know, magazines, you know, science fiction fans will recognize Asimov's Analog and Fantasy mm-hmm. and Science Fiction, those type of magazines. So I had a pretty big backlog of previously published short fiction, and I kept having friends and fans ask me, it's like, when are you going to, you know, a lot of these stories, they came out in print magazines and we weren't able to read them, mm-hmm. You know, cause they're not available. The print versions aren't available or, you know, but they're not available online, that kind of thing. So when are you going to come out with a collection? So I started looking around, and as it turned out, the publisher who was publishing my Killday books mm-hmm. had an open call for collections, but it was a blind read, so I had to take, you know, my name and everything off of it when I sent it in, and they had a guest editor who was reading for the collection, and mine just turned out to be one of the ones that they picked to publish, one of the five that they decided to publish out of that open call.
Well, that's fantastic.
It just kind of worked out well. It wasn't planned that way at all, but yeah, So my new collection is out, and it's called The Long Fall Up and Other Stories. And that The Long Fall Up is the title of the first story in the collection, and also it's the story that won a Nebula Award. So it's been widely published and reprinted, and I mean it's been published in Chinese and Romanian and Czech and you know, so that kind of makes sense to name it after that story. But
yeah, I know, absolutely, that's really cool. What was that like? I want to know what that was like. What was your experience winning a Nebula?
Well, I have to say it was exciting and it was cool. I, you know, growing up, it's like I always remembered seeing books, you know, and they would have a tag on the front of them, you know, the ones in the drugstore spin racks, you know, they'd have a tag on front of them saying, you know, Hugo winner or Nebula winner or something like that. And I always thought, well, that's kind of like a stamp of quality right there, you know. And of course, you know, a lot of people probably argue with that. But the thing is, you know, seeing my name on that list of that long list of authors who've
sure,
you know, won these awards before me is just kind of, kind of humbling, and I was a bit gobsmacked, but.
Yeah, amazing.
But yeah, yeah. It was really a great process. You know, I got a phone call at work, and it was a friend of mine that I knew through the Codex writing group. And she goes, "Hey, you know, I'm calling, wondering if you're coming to the Nebula Awards." And it's like, "Well, I hadn't really thought about it." And she goes, "Well, you're nominated. You're you're on the short list." And it's like, "Oh my God, you know." So,
I am?
And yeah. So anyway, it was really strange because a good friend of mine who lives not too far away, Bonnie Jo Stufflebeam, was nominated at the same time, you know, was on the short list at the same time for the same category. So we were basically both vying for trying to win the Nebula for the novelette, which was the story length that, you know, we had written. So it was kind of weird, but a lot of fun also, because she and I were both like interviewed by D Magazine, and we were both invited to read part of our stories down at Wild Detective in Dallas, and
cool.
things like that. So it was kind of like, you know, we were getting to do this thing as kind of a tag team, a buddy thing, you know. Of course, when it came down to it, you know, I felt really weird that I won and she didn't. But I really kind of didn't, you know. I know a lot of every winner always says this. It's like, "Oh, I didn't think I would ever win." But really, I'd read all those stories and I thought, man, I don't even know why I'm on this list. But the people sitting at my table at the Nebula Award, it's like, you should have seen your face when they called your name.
Oh, I bet. So,
but
I know you well enough to know that that's a true statement. You were probably, I could imagine you sitting there being like, this is such a cool, surreal experience to be here and have my name on this, but I know I'm not going to win it sort of thing. And then surprise.
Yeah. I was kicked back with my arm on the back of my wife's chair, you know, and was just like, oh, this is great. You know, I wonder who's going to win, you know?
But, oh, that's too cool.
But yeah, it's definitely been one of the highlights of my writing career, and I'm not giving it back.
No, I mean, like, I've never been a big like awards person, right? But to sit there and like for it to be a Nebula or a Hugo or a World Fantasy, like, that's, like you said, it puts your name in a list of the people you grew up reading, the people you look up to, it's part of the dream you want to achieve, right? So when it actually happens, that's crazy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, kind of, it's kind of like a, I don't know, kind of a bit of a recognition by your peers being a Nebula, you know, that your writing is of a caliber, you know, to be considered, even considered for those, that kind of award. And, And that meant, you know, that meant a lot for me. That carried a, you know, that was pretty powerful for me. So
it's definitely great ammo for when you're feeling imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, shut up, imposter syndrome. Look at that trophy up on the wall.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, super famous guy, what a, do you know that you have a great Wikipedia page?
Yes, I did know that. However, I didn't know it until after it was in existence. It turns out a friend of mine, and he made me promise not to mention his name because he said he didn't want a dozen different people saying, clamoring and wanting to make them pages. But he made it for me too long after I won the Nebula Award, and he did a great job. And I was like, this is so cool.
It is really cool. I looked up your name. I was trying to find your website, and it was like Wikipedia. I'm like, Bill's got a Wikipedia page? What the what? And it's got a really nice picture of you holding your award. I'm like, yeah. Man, he's big time. So tell us a little bit about the, so this is really funny, actually. I think I told you this a while back, but on one of our very first episodes, we were just covering our news stories, and one of them was about the Bain Memorial, or the Jim Bain Memorial Award. And I was reading the thing, like, I didn't even catch it when I first pulled it up, and we covered the news story, and I'm like, do you see that name quoted at the bottom? And JH was like, yeah, what about it? I'm like, that's Bill. Like, I didn't know Bill had anything to do with this. So tell us about that. How did you get involved? What is it? All that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, you know, the contest was my idea. Our local National Space Society chapter was going to host the International Space Development Conference, which is the big NSS conference every year. We were going to host it here in Dallas. And we were talking about doing, you know, different things that maybe hadn't been done before. And I said, well, we ought to have a short fiction contest, but make the science fiction about, you know, like realistic space travel in the next 50 or 60 years. And everybody in my chapter thought that was a great idea. And so I pinged, you know, we pinged the people at NSS, and they thought it was a great idea. And I thought, well, in order to bait people into into entering this contest, kind of, you know, a great thing would be if we could get a magazine signed up, you know, to that would be willing to publish the winner, as, you know, at a professional rate, you know, a professional story rate. And so I knew people at Bain because my first professional sale actually was to Jim Bain's Universe. So back when they had that online magazine. So I knew some people there, and I pinged one of the editors and I said, hey, do you think you guys would be interested in this? And apparently the request went all the way up the ladder to Jim Bain, and he liked the idea. So that I got the green light. So we started it up and was getting people to come in and, you know, getting entries sent in and things mm-hmm. like that. Well, before the contest was ended, Jim Bain died. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, wow, you know, this is bad, you know, for Bain and for, you know, and I didn't know where the contest was going to go, but we finished it up and it was very popular. And then, so Tony Weisskopf at Bain pinged me a few months later and says, hey, would you in NSS consider doing this every year, you know, as an annual thing? Mm-hmm. And and Jim really loved, you know, this kind of science fiction, and he liked the idea of this contest. And so we'd like to name it in his honor, and if it's okay with NSS. So I guess the rest is history. I've been running it ever since. And that first contest was in 2007. So
wow.
So it's been a while.
Well, that is super cool. It's super cool that you're still doing it too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my friend Michelle Munsler, I don't know if either of you have ever met her. She's a local writer. She's in my writers group. But she helps me. She's kind of my first reader. She knows the she makes sure that, you know, the entries have like followed the guidelines and stuff like that, because you'd be amazed at the stuff we get, you know, like zombie stories and not zombies in space, just regular zombie stories. You know, we got part of a screenplay. We got a bizarre manifesto, you know, with like flame, you know, animated flames in the background of the file, and just all wow. kinds of interesting stuff that you get when you open these contests up. So
I believe it.
Anyway,
I believe yeah. it. You know, Jessica, yeah. JH, she's a freelance editor, right? So she gets hired, and some of the things are like, they're so far removed from reality, you know?
Yeah.
He ripped his heart out of his chest and handed it to him. Things like that, you know?
Yeah, we get the
weird
the
formatting things as well. Like, I had one person, I think we figured out after I had edited the book that she didn't have a computer or Word. And so she couldn't see like all my track changes, and she needed all the like comments in like their own separate document that she could just open and read.
Wow. But
that one was just a whole big thing. It's like,
she wrote a novel on her phone or something, right?
Like, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, I get it. If I didn't have any money or a computer or paper, I'd still write and probably do it on my phone, but
right. Man. I think there's a difference there with like you have your situation and you just do what you can, but you'd also have to know like the rest of the world is like, especially in the author community, like they're probably going to have computers. They're going to be working off of computers when they're in the documents, like at any stage of like, you know, the, you know, traditional publishing industry, like you're going to have that. So you'd think you'd figure out some sort of way to do that, like go to the library or something.
Yeah. All right. So Bill, what's your advice for the budding author? It can be for business or craft or both.
Well, this is probably advice that everybody gives, but to be honest, you just can't quit. Because it is so, sometimes it can take a long, long time, you know, to seem like you're making any headway at all. It seems like you're just pounding your head against the brick wall, and you keep writing stories or novels and sending them in, and they you get rejection after rejection. And most of the time with rejections, you don't get any explanation. It's like, well, okay, you didn't like it obviously, but why, you know? And so you're kind of working in the dark and feeling your way along, and it can really be disheartening, and it's real easy for people to get disillusioned and give up. And, I mean, for me, my first published story was in 2000, and then it took another 6 years before I sold one at professional rates. And then once I sold that first prose story, it's like, man, I've broken through the veil now. And, you know, here I come. And it took me another 2 years after that to sell my next professional sale. Things started opening up a little more then, but I mean, I still get rejections, you know, all the time, and still get rejections and have no idea why. So right. it's hard business. And a lot of new writers, you know, they'll hear these rumors. It's like, oh, well, you know, you have to know somebody or you'll never get in. And you have to, you have to do all this stuff and do, you know, but that's not really true. It's, if you look at the numbers of the stories that these people get, I don't remember the exact numbers, but Charlie Finley, when he took over at Fantasy and Science Fiction, I think the first year he was there, they had like 35,000 submissions, and they bought like 13 stories. So, I mean, it's just a staggering amount, you know, that, and so it's like, you have to understand, you know, the numbers involved, and that, you know, they have to pick what they think is best for the magazine, and your story may be perfectly good, but if it doesn't fill some kind of a slot that they need, or if it doesn't rise above other stories, other similar stories, then right. they're going to have to pass on it because they simply can't buy that many stories, you know? So,
yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately. And that's what you, you know, you'll hear that talking to any publisher, listening to any editors, right. you know, just, you know, talking about their process. So you'll hear how much they get. It's just staggering, you know?
Right. Yeah, I've come across the same thing in the agent world where the agents would talk about, like, you know, they've just been open for a month and already have 800 or 900 queries just in that 1 month, or, you know, could be as short as a week. Like, they're just flooded.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was going to say, the submissions that come in for the contest that I run, that's really about the only slush I read now. I used to read slush for Adrian Simmons, his on like,
hey, that's the train. That would be a train.
It's a train.
All right, train ad. Bill says he remembers what he was talking about. We're going to find out.
So I used to slush read for Heroic Fantasy Quarterly, yeah. which is an online fantasy magazine run by Adrian Simmons, who's a longtime friend of mine. And
great guy.
Yeah. And he puts out a great magazine. So I used to slush read for him. And I also read, you know, of course, the stories that come in for the Bane contest that I run. And one of the things that is very true is what I said earlier about, you know, the story may be perfectly good. It's just, it just doesn't rise above the others, you know. So mm-hmm. so I guess kind of my takeaway from that is to kind of approach story, try to find a way to approach stories from a different angle and with different elements, as opposed to just writing the same kind of thing that you've read before. Because if you've read it before, so have the editors and publishers. You know, it's probably, you know, if you've read a story like that before, they've probably read 100 of them. So just try to come up with something unique and original and look at things from a different angle. And I think that would helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. All right. Fair enough. Okay. Should we do the news?
Yeah.
I'm not even going to stop it because we're only a minute and 30 in. You guys aren't going to hear the transition sound for the news today. Bummer. You'll hear it for the next segments. Oh, wait. No, you are, because I'm not ready to do the news. Just kidding. Pause. Okay, for real this time, we're going to do the news, and JH has got the first one.
Yeah, so Goodreads recently put out a survey basically trying to discover how many people read on their phones. The answer they got was 37%, but what's odd about this survey is they only ask people who had recently read either Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn or The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern. So I'm not sure why they picked those two books and just asked those people.
So
it's still kind of interesting to find out, you know, so many people read on their smartphones. But another interesting piece that came out of it was 13% said they only read on their phones, which is just bizarre to me because I always use that as like a last resort.
Yeah, I wish it said how many people total were surveyed, because those are like really interesting mm-hmm. things to know, you know?
Right.
So.
I still wonder why they just picked those two books. Like, yeah, we're just going to ask these people.
It's probably because whoever is in charge of that is like a moron like me and was just like, let's do something silly and let's just do this, you know? Let's just ask the people who've read these books. I don't know, but it's interesting. I would like to know how big of a sample size that was. Because I know, like, it's an interesting mix of people I've ran into. Like, some people don't even realize that, like, they could get the Kindle app on their phone, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And others will tell you it looks like garbage, so they just don't use it, you know?
I used to use the Kindle app a lot and read books on my phone. And because of that, I tend to get larger screen phones. But since I started listening to audiobooks, I haven't been doing that nearly as much. So.
I won an e-reader at a writer's conference a few years ago. So I have that now. So that's kind of my go-to if I do want an e-book, and only if it's not available on, because I think the one I got is, it's a Kobo brand. So you have to use the Kobo store to get books or upload, like if you have a Mobi file or something or an EPUB. But otherwise, if it's not on there, if say it's only available on Kindle, then it's like, okay, I'll get it on the Kindle app. And that's the only way I can read that book. But
yeah, she just got me my first Kindle for my birthday a couple months ago. So I'll probably be done with reading on my phone, I guess, now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's an idea. I can borrow your Kindle if I have one of those types of books.
How dare you? No. All right. Our next one is really fun, which is why I let JH go first and save this one for myself. Apparently, so we were just talking about there's the Nebulas, there's the Hugos. There's the World Fantasy Awards. There are so many awards for books. It's crazy. You could spend all day looking up all the different awards. This one might be my favorite. It is the award for the oddest book title of the year. It is voted on by public people. I guess I don't know what the requirements are. It's the... what is it? The 2023 Diagram Prize for the oddest book title. And all of the nominees are American. So America. And they include, I'm going to read all these titles. They're so good. The 12 Days of Christmas, The Outlaw Carol That Wouldn't Die by Harry Rand. Bat Valley Ferrets, A Rewilding of the Colorado Plateau by Lawrence Linhart. Danger Sound Klaxon, The Horn That Changed History by Matthew F. Jordan. I don't know if I can even do this one and keep a straight face. Dry Humping, A Guide to Dating, Relating, and Hooking Up Without Booze by Tawny Lara. I Fart in Your General Direction, Flatulence in Popular Culture by Don H. Corrigan. And finally, The Queerness of Water, Troubled Ecologies in the 18th Century by Jeremy Chow. So get out there and vote, guys. Pick your favorite.
I am a bit surprised that none of Chuck Tingle's titles made it onto the
show. Yeah, right. Yeah. So I got to know, if you were put down to it, which one of these are you guys voting for your favorite?
Ooh. I think I have to go with I Fart in Your General Direction just because that's a Monty Python reference.
Fair enough. Bill?
I think it's got to be the dry humping. I mean, that's just, in my opinion, that rises above all these other ones in weirdness. I mean, it's...
I think I'm probably with you. I appreciate the I Fart in Your General Direction reference. And there is a certain eloquence to the queerness of water. But I think, yeah, I think dry humping is probably the winner for me. Man, do you like, here's the only problem though. Could you imagine being the author who didn't mean for the title to seem odd or ridiculous? And then you get added to this.
You become famous, you win, you become famous. And it's like, yeah, well, I didn't intend that, but okay.
I would with like, I was filling something out the other day and it wanted my accolades. And I'm just imagining, like, you know, winner of the Audis book title of the year. In fairness, what I did have to put in there was I put the only author who's ever sponsored a race car. Probably.
Probably.
Jeez. All right, Jade, you want to give us the next one? It's not nearly as fun.
So, no, it's not. Barnes & Noble announced they are sunsetting their Nook reading app for Windows. So this came out on November 29th, basically saying their Windows app would no longer be available. People who already have the app can still use it. And as an alternative, you can use Nook for web or the app for your mobile phone. So just the Windows app on your computer that they're no longer going to support.
Yeah, and they didn't really say why, but I mean, I guess usually when something like this happens, maybe there's just not enough people who are using it and downloading it for it to be worthwhile for them to deal with security patching and all that kind of stuff, right?
Right. Yeah, I've also had, I came across this with some of my beta readers, like at least for that, you know, small community I've spoken to, a lot of them said they don't like reading on the computer.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that has something to do with it. If like you're just the average reader, like a lot of them saying they're using their phones, they have e-readers, they have audiobooks, and of course physical books. So maybe they dislike reading on their computer as much as I dislike reading on my phone.
Yeah, it's totally possible, right? So I can remember, you know, before I started writing seriously, I had a few electronic books back in the day on an old laptop, and I didn't enjoy reading on that as much. But now, after years of writing and editing, I think we're just desensitized to it, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's different when I'm writing my own books and I'm reading back through for editing or, you know, editing one of yours or a client's. But I don't read for pleasure on my computer.
Right.
Like I stick, like I said, with the physical books, audiobooks, my e-reader.
All right. And our next one, this is one of those where I feel like I probably should know more about this than what I do. But there's a company called Bookwire, and their audiobook service, Way, which is short for We Audiobook You, which is a fun name.
All right.
It's a German company. I don't know. They are expanding their services to English, Brazilian, and Spanish markets. So what was interesting to me about this is I was like, okay, so this is like a, maybe like a Findaway Voices or something. Because it sounds like a service where you reach out to them, you hire them, and they help you get your audiobook created. They have both human and automated narrators, and they can do the book in up to 5 different languages. What surprised me, though, was seeing the numbers. So it says they've worked with 2,500 different publishers, which, you know, a lot of those are, you know, almost certainly going to be indie, I would assume. But they've created over 200,000 audiobooks to date. So that's quite a lot, right? Like, that's not small potatoes.
Yeah, that is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was kind of surprised when I saw those numbers. Like, I probably should have heard of them before, I would think, you know. I guess one of their selling points is they're supposed to have, like, a really good dashboard where, you know, like, if you're signed up to work with them and they're working on your project, they have this dashboard to let you know where everything's at and have a way for you to reach out to them and work everything through. So I guess maybe we haven't heard of them because it's German. But now it's expanding, you know, into English and I guess probably available to use for people in the U.S. I don't know.
All right. Next one. So Amazon has an app called Comixology that's basically for like reading comics and manga. They announced that they are actually going to sunset this as of the 4th of this month. So that's already happened. It looks like they merged with Kindle, and they've already had most of their readers move over to Kindle already. But, yeah, it sounds like a lot of people are still kind of upset about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never used it, but I could see where that's annoying, right? I hate it whenever I have to move apps. Like, I can remember I can remember when Google made the decision to stop letting you use the Google Music player built into your phone. I'm still angry about that. I still haven't found a music app to play my MP3s I like as much, you know?
Right. They're about to do the same thing with podcasts as well. They're moving everything over to the YouTube.
Oh my gosh.
The Google Podcast is going away.
Google, listen. I know you can hear me because you're going to have AI scraping my voice. YouTube is great for videos. It's kind of sucks for music. It probably is going to suck for podcast. Everything doesn't have to live in one app, guys. It's fine. It's fine to have multiple good products. Ask Microsoft. Yes. They've been doing it for years.
Agreed.
Yeah, I guess, well, and some people, I guess, you know, like they have a, like just on the screen in front of us, there's a lot of people who are tweeting and things or Xing. Do you call it tweeting still now that it's X, or is it Xing? I don't know.
I don't know.
Galloping. They were people galloping their thoughts onto the interwebs. Some people were saying like their stuff didn't sync over and yada, yada. I get it. I wouldn't be happy either if I used it, right?
Yeah, that would be, I would be so upset with that. If mine weren't syncing, like, oh. See, it goes back to that idea of, like, it was kind of why I resisted getting digital books for so long. So it's like, if something happens with, you know, the app that you purchased it on, like, you just lose it? Are you able to download it? How can you access it at that point?
Right.
It's like, is it really yours?
Yeah. It's a weird thing when we buy digital copies of things, we kind of assume they're ours forever, but sometimes maybe they won't be, you know?
Right.
It's sometimes authors end up getting a double whammy for me, or a double purchase, because sometimes I listen to the audiobook of something that I really love, and then I'll go out and buy the print version.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Yep. Right.
For one, I want to have it, you know, I want to have it. But number two, sometimes I want to go and read through areas where and see how did they do that? How did they construct this this scene? And you can't really do that with an audio book.
Right. Yeah, I've also found for like fantasy novels, especially if they have like the map at the front of the book, like I can't see that just driving in my car listening to my audiobook. So I either need some sort of PDF download that comes with my audiobook, or I need a physical book I can reference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a smart move that Amazon, they've been doing it for a while now, but they have for certain, I don't know if they have to be, I don't know what the deal is. I don't know if they have to be self-published titles or what, but there's certain ones where if you've bought the audiobook, you can get the ebook at a discount. Mm-hmm. I don't think they do the hard copies that way yet, but it's a cool idea, I think.
Right.
All right, here's the real question. Are you doing the voice for us this week, JH, or do I have to do it?
Didn't I do it last time?
Maybe.
I think it's your turn.
Maybe. All right. Dang it, Christopher. In our continued coverage of our robot overlords. I forgot how to talk in the middle of that. In our O-Bot.
I doubt it.
That was as bad as me messing up Bill's name earlier. Whatever. Robot stories. Here we go. Okay, so for our AI news this week, the Authors Guild has put out a survey. So if you have strong feelings about AI, they have put out a survey. It is public. You can go to it and you can make your opinions known. In particular, it asks a lot of questions around licensing and royalties and that sort of a thing. I did it. I did the survey. It took me less than 5 minutes. And we'll put a link to it in the show notes if anybody's interested in being able to express an opinion on that. I think this is probably part of what they're using to, you know, they're gathering this information from us to go continue their conversation with the U.S. Copyright Office and things. So
yeah, I'll have to go do that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't want to be the one to tell everyone that they should, but I'm going to. I think you probably, if you are concerned about how AI is impacting our industry, you're concerned about what it's going to do in the future, it would probably be worth your time to go take the 2 minutes to fill out the survey and keep an eye out, because this isn't the first one they've done, and I imagine they'll do more as the conversation continues, right?
Yeah, I definitely want to do it too. So yeah, definitely put the link in there.
Yeah. Bill, I'll do you a solid. I'll just send it directly to you when we're done.
You are all right. I always say that about you. You're just all right.
So our next one is one of the writers at Good eReader put out an article to help us identify AI-generated ebooks in Kindle Unlimited. And I thought this was pretty valuable. It would definitely be worth actually going, again, I'll put the link in the show notes. It'd be worth actually going to the link because she has some nice screenshots. But effectively, what she says is a lot of times they will have capitalized titles. So not necessarily like on the cover, but on the product listing, the titles will be all caps for some reason. And obviously no publisher, no indie person is going to put their title in all caps. So that's a good thing. The other thing she called out, which was wild to me, is she said that the names are often Asian names, which is wildly specific.
For the authors?
Yeah, the author. Sorry, I should have clarified. The author names are often Asian names, which is wild. I don't know. Yeah. It's oddly specific, right?
Yeah, that's strange.
Yeah, so she didn't elaborate or say why she thought that was, but she does have a screenshot up showing, and she has a list of names. I will absolutely totally butcher if I try to say them, so I'm not going to, but again, link in the show notes. The other thing she said is that the book covers will look like they were made from a template, as in they'll be just kind of cheap, janky covers. She said you'll see similar cover art across multiple different authors, which is a hint, and they'll often be less than 100 pages. So, you know, if you're thinking about buying one and you click on it and you go down to the total page count, if it's like 20 pages, you might be looking at an AI book, right? And then they will be published this year, obviously, is the other. And I didn't even think about that one, but it's obvious once you hear it that, yeah, of course, it'd be published this year, right?
That's good information to know.
Yeah, for right. Sure. You know, if you're using Kindle Unlimited or anything. I mean, and look at this one, the one in the screenshot she has. This one made it up to number 2 in its category. Number 15 in another category, and number 54 in another category. That means some sales were happening, right? So unfortunately, this is going to be something people in the indie space are competing against, is people pumping out, you know, garbage AI books and loading them up and just trying to make some money off of them, you know?
It's hard enough to get your voice heard. You know, when there's so many people out there trying to publish their books. But now this just is watering it down even more. It's going to make it even more difficult.
Right.
Right. Yeah, it's not good.
I was going to add, just looking at the screen, that one category, and you've clicked away from it.
Oops.
The one category was also very oddly specific, that 45-minute teen and young adult short reads.
That is I heard a stat today, actually. I heard a stat today that said there were like over a million categories actually within Amazon.
Wow.
Yeah. You wouldn't think that, right? You'd think maybe several hundred, but you wouldn't think over a million, but I guess it's possible. All right. So our final AI story, the Association of American Authors submitted a second round of comments to the U.S. Copyright Office about AI. Spoiler alert, they said big tech's claim that its fair use is nonsense. And Google Drive is trying to crash my computer right now. It did not appreciate that. Come on, big tech, leave me alone. I'm just, don't kill the messenger here. Stop trying to crash my computer. this article is available on Publishers Weekly. It's super long, so I'm not going to get into the nitty gritty of it. But they had one quote in there I thought was pretty fantastic. It says, it is deeply ironic that these billion-dollar companies bemoan the financial burden they would face if they were required to pay reasonable license fees to the copyright owners whose works are the very building blocks of Gen AI and whose livelihoods are threatened by the same systems.
Yeah, that's a really good quote, and it is dead on.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. All right, well, that is our news.
All right, for our tools section this time, we're going to talk about portable monitors.
Oh, man. Do you know why I thought about this?
Why?
because when I walked into my office earlier and I was like, man, what are we going to cover for the tools section? I had a new portable monitor in a box sitting in my chair. And I was like, oh, let's talk about that. This was a game. I don't know why I haven't talked about it before, because this is one of those things that was like a game changer for me. Because one of the things I'm really bad about is, obviously at home I have a really nice setup with a great big screen, and I pigtail my laptop off of it, so I have two screens. And what I would find is when I go out into the world with a what?
Pigtail.
Yeah, what else you can call it?
Piggyback.
Daisy chain. That's what I said. that better not be another train. I hope not. So anyways, when I would be out in the world, like maybe we'd go to a coffee shop or wherever, I have a weird mental barrier where there's certain things that are easier to do with two screens. And I'd be like, well, I'm just not going to do that right now. I'll wait till later when I can get home, when I can set up on my own thing and blah, blah, blah. And then on a whim one day, I was like, I wonder if they make portable monitors. And they certainly do. I bought a ViewSonic, which I don't remember what I paid for it at the time. I've had it for a year and a half, 2 years now. I got it on Amazon. The same one I got today is like $170, I think. The one I just picked up, I just burnt some of my Amazon points to get a second one because I can't be bothered to change things out of backpacks. That's annoying. So I picked up a second ViewSonic. It was $100. And it's amazing. I mean, it literally, so the one I have, the laptop can power it, right? So if I hook it into my MacBook will power it. If I plug in my MacBook, it will go full bright and everything. If I have it unplugged where we're just running off battery, it'll power it, but it'll try to dim it a little bit. If I plug a power supply directly into the monitor, it will then actually power my MacBook. Crazy. But it just gives me a simple second screen. It's super lightweight. I can carry it around in a backpack with me. Whenever we go to the coffee shop, I set it up. Jade used to make fun of me about it. She'd be like, look at you with all your stuff. And then one day some guy stopped and he was like, good call on the second monitor. It's a game changer, right? And I was like, yes, sir. And now JH got her own.
I have never tried that. When I go to write at the coffee shop, I mean, even when I write at home, I make sure I don't hook my laptop into like a full-size keyboard or a full-size monitor, because I don't want to have to transition between those when I'm writing. So I write the same setup when I'm out at the coffee shop or I'm at home. But if I were able to use dual monitors in both places, then that, especially when you're editing, when you get like edits back from, from an editor or from your critique group or whatever, you can have one of them on one screen and you can have your working document on the other. That would make things way easier. So I'm going to have to look into that.
Right.
Yeah. The other thing for me, I usually have an outline that I have in Excel. So if I'm actually writing, I'll throw that outline on the other screen there. That way, if I need to check a character's name, or if I'm kind of like, wait, what was I doing in this scene? I just glance over and see it and then get right back to work, you know?
Right. Yeah. I'll clarify, when I would make fun of Phil, it's not for having the second screen, because I use second screens. I love second screens. It was literally just that he would like pack up his whole backpack just full of all these cables and screens and laptops and got to take them with him. That was more of what I was making fun of. I totally get the second screen thing and I love them.
I do. I take this also here. I'll show Bill. The listeners can't see. This also goes with me every time in the backpack. Right?
You must have a huge backpack.
I do. So I take my ergonomic keyboard with me and my mouse. I have a little mouse pad. So I just have this whole little setup. I'll pop out. And yeah, she always was laughing at me like, you're so ridiculous. But it's good. It's great.
Whatever works.
Nope.
That's right. JH, what brand is yours?
I'm looking at it right now. The bottom says QQH, and I don't know what that stands for. And I'd have to look at the store page where I bought it to actually see.
Yeah, I mean, the moral of the story is there's a ton of options for them for around $100 on the Zaun.
Yeah.
I've had, like I said, I've had the one I've had for a couple years now is a ViewSonic, and it runs for about 170. And I can't say enough good things about it. I absolutely love it. The other one is a cheaper one I just got today, so I don't know how good it's going to be. But the ViewSonic, it's been amazing. Like, and I've taken it all over the place. I've traveled with it. It's been to New Orleans, Kansas City, Colorado. It's been through airports, all of the above, and I've not managed to break it yet. So highly recommend.
Right. And I know mine was less than 100. I want to say it was in the $80 to $90 range, and I've had no complaints with it. It was very easy to get going and set up.
Yeah. So highly recommend. All right, guys, before we start Creatives on Fire, something magical just happened. He went away to the deep, dark mines of Moria, and we feared him lost to us forever. Yet he has returned to us with tales of goblin stank and fiery Balrog farts. It is our beardless dwarf paladin, Christopher. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Phil.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm not dead. That, or we're pulling a full Gandalf the White. I'm not sure yet.
Yep. Gandalf 2.0.
Do we want to continue our trend of just ignoring the fact that you weren't here for a little bit?
I mean, you just ruined it, but otherwise, yes, let's pretend like I'm not here. I like it.
All right, fair enough. All right, so for Creatives on Fire, I thought we would talk to Bill a little bit and celebrate what he's got going on this week with his retirement. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I've been working in the aerospace industry for, I don't know, roughly 35 years. And this one company, oddly enough, I started at this company, it was Rockwell Collins, and then it merged with United Technologies and became the Collins Aerospace Division of United Technologies. And then it merged with Raytheon and to become Raytheon Technologies, which just changed their name to RTX. And I never moved my chair the whole time. So this is the way that the aerospace and defense industry works. But anyway, this same company for like 22 years. So, I'm retiring to do just, to a little early to spend, to focus more on writing and to, travel and play video games and just sleep late. And
nice. I want to do that. Yeah. That's the one thing that's hurting for me the most right now is like, I don't have really any time to play games.
Yep.
It's just like, same. You know, what kind of a gamer is Bill Ledbetter?
I have a PS4 and I play No Man's Sky. Mm. That wouldn't surprise most people. I play that a lot. And then I bounce around to other, to other things, they have an alien, alien, I can't remember, but it's really cool because they've really captured the vibe. I mean, it's an older game. It's been out, I don't know, 6-7 years, but they really captured the vibe of the first movie, the technology and the tension level and all that. So I play that a lot. And,
oh, that's fun.
I don't know. I bounce around from thing to thing. We played Stray when it came out. I don't know if you've ever.
Oh, that's fun.
You remember that game with the cats? That was a lot of fun. So yeah,
you must be talking about Alien Isolation.
Alien Isolation. Yes, that's the one. I am not a huge first-person shooter game fan. I'm more, strategy or like survival type games, like these. I also loved The Last of Us, and I started playing The Last of Us 2, and I got about halfway through it, and something crapped out on my machine.
Oh no!
And when I went back to reload the game, it was gone. Oh. So I'm gonna have to start over again, and I haven't done that yet. The Last of Us was a great game too. So
have you looked at Starfield?
I haven't, and it's because I don't have I mean, I could play it on a PC, but you know, I'm kind of spoiled on using a PS4, but and it's not available for PS4. So
I
keep hoping that it'll come out for it. It's on Xbox and PC.
You know, you can take like an Xbox controller and use that with a PC, right?
Yes. Yeah. I have an Xbox controller and I have used it with my PC. And I just, I haven't done that yet either. But I probably, once I retire, I'll have a lot more time to play around with that.
I'm so jealous of you right now. Man, that's so exciting. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to it.
So did the dates, was the dates coincidence, or did you plan it so that you would have a book coming out the same week that was your last week of working?
That was not, that wasn't on purpose. It was just a coincidence. I'd kind of planned on just, you know, like retiring at the end of the year. What's going on?
There's another train.
Yeah.
So we're not doing another train ad. This is like the fourth train during this episode. It's not happening, guys. You get one. You're getting one. The rest of these trains are getting cut out. Sorry, Bill. The tracks are so busy tonight.
Wow.
I was going to make my retirement at the end of the year, but it, I found out, you know, I started thinking through and it's like, well, most, you know, all the people I need to deal with to get this thing finished are going to be gone, you know, the end of the year. So, you know, I'm going to do it earlier in December. And so anyway, it just kind of fell into that. So, but yeah, the end of this week is going to be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
And just thinking like best weekend ever, except it never ends.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I saw somebody say being retired every day is Saturday. Yep. And it's like, yes, I can do that.
So give us a little bit for the business side of things. Give us a little bit of your villain origin story and sort of your process for going through when you got published and got your agent. And I'm going to mute myself for this train.
Oh, I should too. Good idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, all the writers out there, you know, beating the bushes and sending, submissions and queries out looking for an agent are all going to hate me because I kind of came into this through the back door and not back door because, oh, I knew somebody, but because I didn't get an agent, because of my novel. When I won the Nebula Award, I was pinged by my agent who lives in Dallas, but he works, for one of the big New York, firms, you know, agencies. And he said, hey, since you live in the Dallas area, he said, he says, even if you already have an agent, let's get together for a beer. Cause I just want to meet you, you know the local writers. And it's like, well, as it happens, I do not have an agent. And, but one of the things that he was interested in because of, my short fiction, he sold, novels and short fiction to, you know, like say Netflix and Hulu and stuff like that for some of his other clients. And he wanted to do that. He wanted to try and do that with some of my short fiction as well. And I was like, yeah, I'm totally fine with that. But I have this novel that I've been shopping around, and that was Level 5. And he goes, "Yeah, let me see it. Let me see if I can find a home for it." And then he did eventually at Audible Originals. So that is kind of how I got my agent, and he's worked out really well. He has most of his clients are like thriller and horror writers. So I'm kind of a rarity in his, in his client list, you know, being science fiction, but it's done well by me so far. So, yeah. And so most people go just the opposite way, you know, they send out the novel to different agents and then an agent ends up liking the novel and they'll say, yeah, I'll represent you and try to sell your novel. But, you know, sometimes, and I've seen this, been in the business long enough, I guess, to see it, kind of the heartbreak of it. I have several friends who have really good top of the line agents who they'll take a book and they'll go to bat for it and say, oh, this is great. This is a great book. And they'll shop it around and they still can't sell it. So, you know, having a great agent doesn't always automatically mean that you're going to sell your book. I have several friends who've gone through that process, and it's kind of heartbreaking to watch because it's a long slog, and then in the end they end up not selling the book after all. So, but you know, like I said earlier, you just keep at it. And it's like, well, that book didn't fly, so maybe the next one will, and you just keep going. So.
Right.
I don't know, Bill. I think you have the right strategy. Just go win a Nebula, guys.
Yeah, you know, I was at a small regional conference a couple weeks ago, and I was talking about outlining. I was talking about outlining and writing synopses, and somebody asked me about how I got an agent, and I mentioned that, and that was the comment that came out of the crowd. It's like, oh, so it's easy. Just go win a major award and boom, you can get an agent. And it's like, yeah, that's the way I did it. Worked for me.
I love it. That's great. Well, it did work, Bill.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right. Well, I guess we should probably start wrapping this thing up. So, Bill, one more time, you want to just throw another pitch out for your new book?
Yeah. The third and final book in my Kill Day series, which is called Level 7, will be coming out tomorrow in audio. And then it'll be sometime next year in print. You can find... You know, all of my, you can sign up for my newsletter, which is the best way to keep track of what I have going on. And I also have a website at williamledbetter.com. So, and I also have a new collection of short fiction out through Interstellar Flight Press. So it's only in print and ebook. It isn't out in audio yet. It may be sometime in the future, but so far not yet. So
I'm going and buying your book right now.
Yay.
Great.
Oh, they won't let me pay for it. They say I can just add it to my library.
What?
Cool.
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah, I've seen that before.
No, we're going to see what happens. This title is being delivered to your library.
Cool.
There. I hope you get paid for that.
Yeah. Well, I got paid a pretty good advance, so I guess in a way I've been paid partially for it already. So
right. There you go.
Yeah, I was curious if those swords, like if they count toward the advance you were paid. You know, but before you start getting royalties, you have to, you know, earn out your advance. And I've been curious if those sorts that I've seen on Audible count towards that or not.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And it's funny because when I get a statement from them, it's broken down. Because there's actually also CDs out there of it that are through Brilliance Audio, I guess. And they're published, I mean, they're through Simon & Schuster, I guess. But anyway, they're distributed through Simon & Schuster. But the royalty statement is broken down and you see how many people bought it using credits and how many people bought it using cash and on down. And it's almost entirely with credits. So. Yeah.
Interesting. I just went back and forced it to take my credits. So I've got level 5 and level 6 now.
Nice.
Cool.
I'll get level 7 tomorrow.
Yeah. You have to let me know what you think.
Will do. Will do. All right, JH, say your goodbyes.
All right. You can find me on all the social media places at my website, jhfleming.net. You can hire me on Fiverr to edit your book. I don't think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but I have a newsletter and you get a free short story when you sign up for it. So you could find that on my website. And I also, I also have a Patreon and Ko-fi page that I'm getting set up, going to have exclusive short stories as part of those. So you should check those out. And I'm going to also try to get my YouTube channel going. So look for that too. J.H. Fleming at all of those.
All right. And Christopher. As always, Christopher does not want to talk to you. Do not bother him.
You haven't been able to find me. What makes you think anybody else can?
But let's get those hashtags going again. Hashtag Chris sounds hot. I am best smelling author, Philip Dreher Duncan. And you can find me at philipdreherduncan.com. You can find my books at places that have books. Go buy The Blade Mage. I hear it's going to be on sale on Christmas. All right. Bill, super glad that you joined us. Super excited for you about the book and the retirement. Both are amazing.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me on the show. I've had a great time. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's our pleasure. And I guess it'll probably be a while before we see you. So we'll have to, I don't know, maybe we'll sneak you back on at some point or something.
Sure. I'm retired. I'm going to have a lot of time now.
Yeah. Now, which day does the book come out?
The 7th, tomorrow. And there's not a link for it yet for level 7. Or there wasn't the last time I checked today.
There is not. I wasn't going to say it, but there is not. I'm like, what are they doing?
The other two actually had pre-ordered links, but this one didn't. And they said that they'd been running a little bit behind on it, but it would still be out on December 7th. So it's like, okay. Mm.
So bear with me on this one, Phil.
Yes, Chris.
In our continued coverage of AI in level 7 tomorrow on the 7th.
That's right.
I love it. I love it. All right. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Chris, for making an appearance. And yeah, that's an episode, I think.